Got a couple more papers before lunch. The next one is Jerry Gibson. Among the other elected and appointed positions he has held, Jerry Gibson is a past president of both ARSC and YAZA. Prior to his current job as audio and moving image preservation specialist for the Library of Congress's Preservation Research and Testing Division, God, couldn't they have given you a smaller title? Jerry was the library's curator for audio and moving images. Other professional work includes chair of the AES's Audio Preservation and Restoration Standards Committee, co-chair of the joint AES-ANSI Technical Commission of Technical Standards, related to the preservation of optical and magnetic recordings, and member of a variety of groups, including the Board of Advisors to RIT's Image Permanence Institute. He's been a consultant on AV and preservation-related issues to Sarasota Music Archive, Rutgers University, the University of California, the State of Tennessee, the National Park Service, and the government of Trinidad and Tobago, as well as UNESCO. Work in progress includes a multilingual glossary of terms related to the archiving of AV materials and a comprehensive bibliography of AV preservation issues. His topic today is the current state of digital audio preservation at the Library of Congress.
Thank you. I didn't really mean for you to read the whole thing, but okay. You didn't get my birth date in there either, but okay. Thank you. I'm sorry that I haven't been able to be here for the last couple of years or at the ARS conferences because of a combination of family health problems, but I'm happy to report that we're doing much better, and it's great to be back with you. So it's good to see you all, to see old friends and to meet some new people as well. Before I get into my presentation, I would like to mention that I had just spoken briefly with Sam Berlowski about it. And Sam and I did not have a chance to talk before I left the library. Before he left, he was in the midst of preparing for another receipt of a collection at the library. And so, Sam, I welcome you. If you have more current information on some of my topics or different perspectives, feel free to share them with us. And particularly, we'll talk about some about Culpeper and a few other things. First of all, if you're waiting to hear what digital format the Library of Congress has selected, I'll save you the trouble and you can go have coffee and visit with other people. The Library of Congress does not yet accept digital for its preservation format forms. It is not its preferred form yet. Can I have the first overhead? Part of the question is maybe personified by this. I'd seen one earlier, but I wasn't able to get it. It was about Priscilla with the red big letter A on her chest, which I'm not sure that stands for analog or something else. But in this case, my caption here, and we'll come back to this with possible other captions later, is be careful or the technology can eat you alive. But with that in mind, do bear in mind, as I say, that we at the Library of Congress have not yet accepted or adopted digital for our preferred form of preservation. Can I have the second one? Instead, we still subscribe to an approach that was put forward in the ARSC-AAA's report some 10 years ago on what an audio preservation format should be. These were four criteria that we spent a couple of days hashing out and back and forth. In principle, these same criteria have been adopted by the International Association of Sound and Audio Visual Archives and by the Audio Engineering Society's Preservation Standards Committee. But if you don't know it, if you can slide that page up a little, there's a citation at the bottom. It's on pages 13 and 14 of that ARSC report, and I'm sure you all have copies of it and sleep with it and puts you to sleep every night. It's boring enough to, I think. But we still subscribe to that because the very reason stated here, that the situation has changed somewhat for the four criteria that were put forward, but we at the Library of Congress do not yet feel that it's there in the form that we're ready to accept and to walk away from our analog. Does LC make or acquire digital recordings and attempt to preserve them? By all means, yes. First of all, we acquire, just as most of you do, I'm sure, or at least some of you do, CDs and other digital recordings. In addition, all preservation copies that are made, which are made on open reel analog tape, are also have an RDAT service copy made. And I was just informed at the beginning of this week that we are also making magneto-optical disc copies of all live concerts and events at the library. Is that correct, Sam, or are you? Okay. So we are making them, but as far as the in-house opinion is, the Preservation Master is the open reel 10.5-inch, 1.5 mil polyester-based analog tape copy. Do we think that digital will be adopted for preservation? For a number of reasons, probably yes. There are the strengths which we've heard about digital, the ability to clone, to copy, to migrate it from one form to another without loss of data or information, which clearly from a preservationist standpoint of need would have to be a primary concern. Another issue, which I think all of us probably also live with, is the seeming disappearance are being phased out of analog, both raw tape and the equipment. The announcement, I guess, approximately 18 months, maybe 2 years ago now, from 3M, of their walking away from analog tape shocked a lot of us and hopefully woke us up to start moving and considering some of the other options. At the moment, to the best of our knowledge, or my personal knowledge, there are three manufacturers of raw tape for analog audio preservation, or which would be applicable for it. Those three, and if you know of others, please share them with me. Those three are Zonal in England, BASF in Germany, which is now owned by a Korean firm, I believe, and Quantigy. If there are there other firms that anyone is aware of?
What about Max LTDK?
Are they making open reel 1.5 mil?
I think so. I haven't heard them stop, that they stopped making.
Okay, then I'll check and see. Does anyone have any experience if they are?
I think Ampex, yeah. Somebody's testing the new reels of tapes to make those.
Well, that's Quantigy.
Yeah, Quantigy, Ampex was taken over by Quantigy, and it's now known as Quantigy. Steve, yes? Okay.
Maxell's tape, the 1.5 mil black back coat, was never a low print tape. It's a very high output.
But it's half mil as well.
No, he's in with one.
Oh, 1.5 mil.
I think it's full of 50-120 on the 10-inch reels.
Okay.
But it's kind of like using Ampex 456 Grandmaster. So you'll get print through problems on it.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hitachi Maxwell is still in production. PDK, I believe, has ceased production.
Okay. The other issue, and possibly even a more concern for us as archivists or collectors, is to be able to get tape equipment. There was recently a half-day seminar in Paris organized by YASF in conjunction with UNESCO. At that time, there were six manufacturers in the world who responded and reported and shared their information on their status of making reasonable quality and reliable tape equipment. Those six were Studer. By this I'm talking about open reel equipment. Studer, Nagra, TIAC, a firm I did not know, STM, which turned out was one of the largest equipment manufacturers because it was an Eastern European Communist Bloc firm, or which supplied tape equipment for all of the radio stations in Eastern Europe and throughout the Soviet Empire. it was STM, Tascam, and Otari. Each of those six maintain that they are in business for the long haul and are expect to stay there. But if any of us talked, or if any of you talked, as we did with 3M, as many as 2 or 3 days before the announcement came out of St. Paul, they ran it for the long haul and expected to stay there. With two exceptions, my understanding is of the six manufacturers I just mentioned, four of them are owned by other corporations, and it is quite possible would be a financial decision that is made outside of the equipment manufacturing world. So it is a frightening situation. You're great. You're correct. Thank you. So there are five, not six. Thank you. So for the combination of reasons, not to mention the improvement in access which digital gives and the desire or need from financial and from administrative control to avoid duplication of effort if at all possible, it is my personal opinion, and I believe it's the opinion of most of my colleagues at the library, that digital certainly will be endorsed and will be adopted for preservation purposes. When is another issue or another concern. What are our concerns about digital? There's a whole laundry list, and I'm sure you've each gone through them all yourself. First of all is the life expectancy of the media and the systems. Not only for the analog materials, which I just mentioned, but for the new technology as well. One thing to be aware of is that data migration is not a new issue. It's been happening since the beginning of civilization. What is new, or what appears to be fairly new at this point, is the speed with which it's becoming imperative to migrate the data from one generation to the next, to copy it from one form to the next, in order to ensure that it is not lost. The file structure and the sampling rates continue to be major issues hounding most of us concerned with the quality of the information and data that is stored and that is selected. The issue of metadata is of what information needs to be captured and who and when will that data be captured is another serious issue to make sure not only that we can identify the content. It's one thing to walk into a stack, into a storage area, or into your collection, and to be able to browse through the items. If you're in a data storage system, it becomes far more complicated. Finally, what will be the target media? How will we choose what we go with? Can I have the third slide up? In fact, I should have asked for this one earlier. One of the things which we have become aware of is that once even have resolved the issue of what the target media will be and how we solve it, we have to keep the both analog and digital alive. Even if all of the archives in this room adopted digital this afternoon as its preservation form, there will be many decades and some feel much longer than that before the analog materials which we want to preserve have been effectively copied and migrated. One estimate at the moment, the Library of Congress, for example, its analog audio collection will require 50 to 75 years at the present rate that it's being copied. Unless there's a significant increase in funding and finance to do that, then we're going to have to keep the analog alive. Yes. That's the entire audio collections. And it is only an estimate. It depends on who's doing the math and what figure you estimate will be the copy time for it to take place. So the analog equipment must be kept alive, the media must be kept alive in order to do it. Another issue, and I'll come back to this one later, and we'll ask Sam to address it because he's much more up on what's happening with it than I am, is the access, particularly from our internal concerns and issues. As you've probably heard, the library is considering an off-site facility for the storage of its AV collections, which we call for shorthand Culpeper. If Culpeper takes place, we will need to have some remote access for data delivery back into the city, into the reading rooms. I'll leave that one for a moment and ask Sam to cover that in a few minutes, if that's okay. And the question of what target media, we have generally come to the conclusion after some discussions with a number of consultants, and one in particular, Bill Storm, who's here with us today, and I'll come back to his report in a moment. But we've generally come to the consensus in-house that at the library that the use of standalone media and systems with media and format and systems differing for each type of data and information we want is probably not a very feasible way for us to approach it. I'll take the next slide. Instead, we have are looking at and are considering the possibility of a digital network system and data system which will hold all data. Whether this is feasible for your own situation or not will be something that you would have to address. There are certain advantages, at least conceptually for me, for having standalone single item systems, a CDR or a magnetic tape or whatever form was to be chosen. But there are significant advantages for a system such as this model is set up to show here for handling all of the digital preservation issues. The general consensus is if you can resolve the issues concerned with digital preservation for audio and moving image, you have probably addressed and resolved most of the other issues, if not all of the other issues, for the other materials in an institutional collection. So if time allows and you wish more, I would ask Bill to address this particular point later. What then is the Library of Congress doing and how are we approaching it? Well, I've already made reference to a couple of one consultancy from Bill Storm. There, by the way, the publications that I'm mentioning will be available. If I have copies available here now, they are here now, or at least one copy is. If you will send me an email address, a message, or a fax, or if not, a letter would be okay, but I suggest email or fax, including your name and address and which publications you want, they will be sent to you at no charge. The Storm Report is called the Unified Strategy for the Preservation of Audio and Video. What we asked Bill to do for us was to help us develop a philosophy, if you will, a strategy to approach the issue of preservation of audio and video. We put very few other parameters around him, and he came up with a paper, an approach, a philosophy, which has been endorsed in principle by every single office in the Library of Congress concerned with it. It gives us a philosophical and a strategic base for approach and for hopefully resolving and answering the digital issues. There's a copy of this here. This is the only copy I've brought because of weight. So if you would not take it, but send me a message requesting it, I'll be glad to see that you get them. A second consultancy was with a man named William Nugent, who some of you here know. Bill was at the Library of Congress for many years. He prepared a manual, a handbook for curators called Digitizing Library Collections for Preservation and Archiving. There's been some disagreement with some of Bill's recommendations, but that's part of the game, I guess, and part of the situation, not the game. It is a very useful handbook. It points out a number of areas to be of concern and to work within. There's a copy of this here as well. In addition to those two, we decided that if we're going to keep our analog collections alive, as well as the digital collections which we're beginning to acquire, we needed to have some idea of the condition of those collections. So we have carried out and are in the process of continuing three risk assessments. One of our motion picture film collection, which clearly carries audio of some interest to a number of us here, the magnetic tape collection, and the optical disc collection. Not only were The consultants asked to examine the collections and advise us on the status of the condition, but also to make specific recommendations in the case of film and magnetics on what to do to extend the life of those collections. The motion picture film report is published. The survey was carried out by the Image Permanence Institute, and here's a copy for a sample there. The magnetic tape report, which was carried out for us by the National Media Laboratory in St. Paul, Minnesota, has not yet been published. I am told it is at the printers. The two things, other than simply being interested in what LC's collections might look like as a possible mirror of what you might expect to find in your own collections, the two things of particular interest in these surveys, I think, might be, one, a model of how we approached carrying out a risk assessment of these type of media, and two, the specific recommendations that were made to us on how to extend the life, to realize the life potential built into the materials. The optical disc, we're approaching slightly differently. We're carrying it out in-house ourselves. We have identified a block of the CD collection from the Motion Picture Division, Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division collections, which we're told should give us a 90 to 95% accuracy reading of the rest of the collections. We are examining them. We are using those items as a reflection of what hopefully will be happening or is happening in the rest of the collections. We will be examining those same discs each year for the next 10 years to determine what changes are taking place under normal storage conditions. That report is in editing stage at the moment, and hopefully will be available within the next 6 months. We have published one bibliography, are in the process of publishing a couple of others. I mentioned the cylinder bibliography, a copy of it is here as well. We have been much more active in the pursuit and development of standards. One of the things which the RSAA report called for 10 years ago was the development of standards. And a number of you here in this room have been actively involved, or were actively involved, and some are still in that process. If you are interested in joining in that process, I would welcome you to work with us. It is not a fast process. If any of you have not worked with standards before and are interested, it is a slow, tedious, laborious, and at many times very, very depressing process. But it does produce product. So I invite you to join us. At the moment, the American National Standards Institute has standards in place for the recommendation for storage to maximize the life of magnetic tape, to maximize storage for the optical discs, for storage of a motion picture film, and has put into place standards for accelerated aging and deterioration of CDRs, CD-ROMs, and CD magneto-optical discs, which we will be implementing hopefully this summer at the library. Under development are storage and handling recommendations for both optical and magnetic. Once again, if you're interested in those would be available from either ANSI or from the Audio Engineering Society, both of whom have web pages. If you're looking for a particular document, contact me and I can point you in that direction. Yes?
What is your email address?
GGIB at LOC dot GOV. And here's some business cards up here on the desk. We are exploring the possibility, we at the Library of Congress Preservation Directorate are exploring the possibility of some cooperative work with other facilities which have in-house the ability to carry out systems, media, and technology evaluation. Thus far, we've identified two, the Bibliothèque Nationale de France in Paris and the National Film and Sound Archive in Canberra. We have an agreement in principle with both that we will be carrying out parallel and supporting tests and evaluations. We have yet to implement them. Let me have the next slide. Finally, something which I had asked for many years before I went to the Library of Congress, asked for again after I got to the Library of Congress and was in the Motion Picture Division, and since I've moved to the Preservation Directorate, we finally, as of this week, have agreed, and in fact, Sam, when you get back, there should be a packet on your desk of something. It is a slow, tedious, laborious, and at many times very, very depressing process, but it does produce product. So I invite you to join us. At the moment, the American National Standards Institute has standards in place for the recommendation for storage to maximize the life of magnetic tape, to maximize storage for the optical discs, for storage of motion picture film, and has put into place standards for accelerated aging and deterioration of CDRs, CD-ROMs, and CD magneto-optical discs, which we will be implementing hopefully this summer at the library. Under development are storage and handling recommendations for both optical and magnetic. Once again, if you're interested in those would be available from either ANSI or from the Audio Engineering Society, both of whom have web pages. If you're looking for a particular document, contact me and I can point you in that direction. Yes?
What is your email address?
GGIB at loc.gov. And here's some business cards up here on the desk. We are exploring the possibility, we at the Library of Congress Preservation Directorate are exploring the possibility of some cooperative work with other facilities which have in-house the ability to carry out systems, media, and technology evaluation. Thus far, we've identified two, the Bibliothèque Nationale de France in Paris and the National Film and Sound Archive in Canberra. We have an agreement in principle with both that we will be carrying out parallel and supporting tests and evaluations. We have yet to implement them. Let me have the next slide. Finally, something which I had asked for many years before I went to the Library of Congress, asked for again after I got to the Library of Congress and was in the Motion Picture Division, and since I've moved to the Preservation Directorate, we finally, as of this week, have agreed, and in fact, Sam, when you get back, there should be a packet on your desk of something else to read, to implement a series of preservation guidelines. Not policy papers, but recommendations and guidelines. In fact, they have changed, the form has changed again from this form, it's so new. I have a set of the first seven that we are sending around for internal review. They consist of labeling of compact discs, environment for motion picture film, for magnetic tape, for shellac discs, for vinyl discs, for acetate discs, and for cylinder recordings. These are the working process, they are works in process, and they would be guidelines distributed by the Library's Preservation Directorate after development with the respective curatorial and hands-on managers of the collections. It happens that the first seven we're putting out deal with audiovisual materials because of the interest that I've been pressing for to get something like this done. The director has endorsed the idea and the concept. They would be in draft form, circulated within the library for 30 days. If revisions would then be made to them, as depending upon the comments and responses that came back,
and they would be, then be implemented and be loaded and available on ELSI's website. These are in draft form only, and once again, you're welcome to review them. Finally then, we haven't adopted digital. We're living with it. We are hopeful of finding a solution and being able to make an intelligent, informed decision. Driving up yesterday, my wife threatened me with great bodily harm, but she also suggested, but that was another issue, I'm sorry. But she said, it sounds as though you're sort of in the eye of a storm, the middle of a hurricane. And in a way, maybe we are finally there. Maybe we finally found, if not some peace and quiet, but at least this institute, the institution which I represent to you today, is trying to look intelligently at the issue and concerns after coming through the fear of it's going to disappear overnight, or it's a passing fancy and will not last, or being flooded with the incoming materials, and what do we do to store and handle them and preserve them. We seem to have at least a small respite of when we can consider our options, and hopefully we can use that time to intelligently and to make a wise and intelligent choice. It's a very quick overview. I hope it of some use to you. If Sam, I think you would all be interested in what the library is looking at and doing with Culpeper. If Sam has, if you can take the time. Am I over time for you? Okay, well, let's put the last back up and we'll go back to the beginning. And the caption maybe on this one shouldn't be that it'll eat you alive, but buyer beware. Caveat emptor. Sam?
Sometimes it's good to be in the eye of the storm, particularly if it's Bill Storm. Bill's report, which I wish he had time to explain to you, but you really couldn't afford him anyway, it is really an exciting development for the library. It was sort of commissioned with this thought that digital was inevitable and the quarter-inch tape was becoming harder and harder to obtain, but it's become even more important with the library's sort of general plans of where we're going because of this, what Jerry mentioned, Culpeper. And I just wanted to tell you about that very quickly. Jerry and I, I work for him, Jerry doesn't. David Francis, the chief of the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division, had established a National Audiovisual Conservation Center in Great Britain for film. David's pretty much a film person, though, as many of you know, his father is, we believe, the oldest living acoustic recording engineer, so he has some background in sound recording, too. He spoke at our local, our meeting. In any case, David's long thought that we've got to get these collections out of the pollution of cities, we've got to get the Library of Congress's Film Preservation Laboratory out of Dayton, Ohio, and into, you know, closer to where we are. And, of course, we're also outgrowing our space on Capitol Hill. And it's difficult to be on Capitol Hill. I mean, it's very convenient, but to ask for such prime real estate when you acquire things at the rate we do, it becomes more and more difficult. So David's long look for a facility outside the library. I won't go into all the details, except that he identified a building in Culpeper, Virginia, 70 miles south of Washington on the way to Monticello, down Route 29. It's not a secret building, but it wasn't a well-publicized one. It is a 140,000 square foot vault built into a small mountain called Mount Pony. It was built in the 1960s for the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, and it was built as a vault to put currency in case of war. It had space for not only lots of money and stamps, but also for something like, on the third floor, it's a three-floor building, 130 Federal Reserve Bank employees in bunk beds. I mean, it was really just a big fallout shelter. It's something, if I every time I go there, I keep humming Goldfinger in the back of my mind. Yeah, it's got all these fences, and they're electrified, and it has a loading dock with, you know, what do they call it? you know, little slots for the...
For a machine gun.
Yeah, for machine guns to fire. Anyway, so David latched onto this building, and everybody said, you know, we don't really have the option to go out and buy buildings for you, David. But in any case, he was able to enlist the interest of David Woodley Packard, who's the, I guess he's in his 60s, the son of David Packard, and is a great film nut. This is a man who spent millions on a film theater in Palo Alto to show his own personal nitrate collection, and I think he sells popcorn in the basement or something. But anyway, the Packard Foundation is a very wealthy foundation. I think almost all of David Packard Sr.'s money went to the foundation itself. And so they have a responsibility to give out a certain percentage each year. And he's given the library $10 million for this facility. We think this facility will cost somewhere totally between $30 and $40 million. So, you know, this is the beginning. The money has, with this money, after almost a year of negotiation, the Packard Foundation bought this building this week. I think on Friday they signed the papers, and on Monday they registered in Culpeper County. I think that cost about $4.5 million, and then $5.5 million, and then the $4.5 million remaining will be used to get this building. Very wisely, they decide, well, you know, we could get a building, and it goes to the Architect of the Capitol. The Library of Congress isn't allowed to own a building. The Architect of the Capitol will then schedule the renovation, but it'll go to the bottom of the list. So the Packard Foundation is going to own this building for a year or 2 years, and do all the most of the renovation, putting in a lot of the shelving themselves, which will be about three times as fast as the government could do it, and probably much cheaper. So we're going to start moving in films this summer out of the general area of Landover. Every motion picture held by the library that's not in a cold vault or not in Dayton will be in this building by summer. Then they're going to put in compact shelving in the basement. They've hired what we hope is a very good architectural firm, Davis Brody, who built the nitrate vaults for the Museum of Modern Art, which have been built, I think it's near Scranton, these new vaults. So we have someone, an architect with archival experience that's used to dealing with people like us. And we're going to just plod along. We're going to slowly rehabilitate this building and move collections in as we can, raise money to move the Dayton facility, which is both a laboratory and nitrate storage vaults, to the building. They, of course, won't be in the building. It's about a 20-acre site. There will be a small reading room in the building for the Beals of the world, who, you know, will settle for nothing less than, you know, the actual item. But for the most part, and this is where I go back to Bill Storm and the digital preservation, it becomes more than preservation. There will be, if this goes as planned, and it's a big, you know, job, have remote access to the collections, where they're actually played over some type of line to the to Capitol Hill, or actually, and hopefully that would be a digital line. And it makes sense. It'd be easier to deal with if the material is digitized first, and you're not actually playing a record, but you're serving a file, right?
But
the machine guns in the turrets. The day you come in, yeah. It's, has your name on it. Has your name on it. Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to sort of fill you in on that because it is a big development. If it goes as the vision is, and that's a big if, most of the staff will move there. At the very minimum, most of the collections will go there, I think. Whether all the catalogers and playback people go will depend on raising the money, will depend on developing Bill's model that you saw, a lot of research and developing and you know, pounding on tables and things. Sarah? No, this is for everything. That's why I wouldn't be here. I'm sorry. No, this is for the audiovisual collections of the library, for film and sound recordings. It's been funded by a man who just adores film, but he does have interest in old recordings. And but that's just the beginning of the funding. Yeah. No, the sound recordings are very much going to be a part of this. I mean, I personally think as we develop Bill's plan, and Jerry was right, just everybody in the library, it is unusual to see everybody sort of come together on something, to really buy the philosophy and really want to work toward it, see the wisdom in it. But as we develop toward that, you know, we can get a lot more bang for the buck with audio than video. I mean, we think Bill's plan applies to video, But I think audio, it's, you know, we'll probably, the start will be something concurrent, but we'll be able to do audio, well, they're smaller files, I'll just put it that way. Yes?
You said you would transmit this to Capitol Hill. Is there plans to go beyond that so you can have access to it?
Well, once it's on a network, you know, there's nothing technologically. I've always said, and I've said this for years and probably in front of this group, I have blind faith in engineers and scientists, but copyright people and intellectual rights holders, I don't have much faith in terms of seeing a future.
Sam's father's a lawyer, his father's a copyright
attorney. Yeah, I have a cousin who's a copyright attorney who created all these damn laws that keep us, I mean, he's responsible for them. He registered the first film for copyright. But so I have very little faith that, you know, we, as much as we could, we would, in terms of legally. But once you start legally delivering them, it's possible. The Library's American Memory Program is starting to try to set up license sites. In other words, it's one thing, as I mentioned earlier today, to get up these Edison files, and because anyone can do that. But as we sort of go into early Columbia, you know, which these 24-year-olds don't even know they own, then they're saying, well, we won't let you just put it out, but maybe there'd be a license site, a public library that you know, signs an agreement that they'll do what they can to keep tape recorders out. I don't want to take up your time, but thanks. I did want to tell you that.
Thanks, Jerry and Sam. They're going to be around for the, I think, the duration of the conference, so please pick their brains on any other information.